Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always get kind of stuck right there.
Oh, okay. We are the personal coach.
Right. Well, we're actually bipartisan.
We have two parties.
Schizophrenic.
Together we can party separately.
I suppose. Anyway, the personal wealth coach is twofold, which is sort of like to fold or not to fold. That is the
right
question.
I think Andy Rogers had something to say about that with his song "The Gambler."
Right, when to fold and then when to hold them, and when to walk away and when to run.
Yeah,
I haven't figured that one out actually.
Anybody that's still listening didn't listen to the song very well because they should have known to run immediately when our voices came on.
Run away, run away. Well, the personal wealth coach is if you're listening to it, you probably figured out that that is the name of a radio program that you're currently listening to. And if you're not listening to it, then you don't know that and you're ignorant.
That's the definition, isn't it?
Yeah. And it also is a wealth management firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission that has a physical location in Salado, Texas. How do you like that?
I like that. You just said something very nice.
That is really,
I guess that's
really cool. And we also have a digital virtual location called, you don't put any spaces, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And I thought that was pretty cool too. So we have like two locations. And we're also, so we're like in two places at the same time. We are a radio program and a investment advisor management firm at the same time. And there's two of us that are in here who both have the same last name. So this is kind of a riddle and a mystery.
It's still a mystery to you?
Why
that is?
Well, it's a math mystery because, you see, there was your mother and I. That's like 1 + 1, right?
Then
we looked around a few years later, and there were 7 of us. So 1 + 1 = 7.
And now there's a lot more than that.
Yeah, but it starts to get complicated because you bring in other factors at that point.
Mm-hmm. You start adding more in, but the multiplication is really what's going on. I think it is.
It's multiplying?
Yes. Yeah, 1 × 1 = 7. It's not 1 + 1.
1 × 1 = 7.
Right.
You know, a guy, I read something really interesting in an astronomy blog website sort of thing. That was...
Wait a minute. You just said something that didn't make any sense. You said something really interesting, and then you said in an astronomy blog.
Well, I'm a geek, so...
I don't know that that's possible.
Well, the point was this guy said E equals MC squared is very confusing to him because nobody explains the units there. So if E equals MC squared, if E equals 1, and 1 equals 1 times... the speed of light, but if the speed of light is 1 light year, so E equals 1 times 1.
I think everybody listening has just gone to sleep.
But you know,
change the channel.
He doesn't. Nobody explains the. He said nobody explains the units that he used there. So if you use different units, you come up with different results. And actually, I won't go into the. There was an answer
units.
There. There was actually an answer there. And it had to do with centimeters, believe it or not. The speed of light measured in centimeters per second. Whoa! By the way, folks, that is a really big number. So you have to use centimeters and grams. You have to do that for intermediate.
Okay, so all of that is physics. We're talking about economics, though. And
what's the difference?
This is actually, there's a good difference here. Really, I mean, in some senses... it's the same thing, and we can talk about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but here is a great example of how our measuring the economy in a different way changed the economy.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
They're about to measure it in a different way, so that's cool.
Yeah, and then it'll probably change it, too.
Right.
Back in 2007 and then in 2008, the Bureau of Economic Analysis changed the way it measured recessions.
Ah.
You remember this. We talked about it on the radio quite a bit when it was going on.
I thought it was the conference board.
It was a conference board.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Board
it wasn't the BEA. Yeah. It was a conference board. All right. So for...
which I really think is fascinating that this private organization gets to officially determine when there is not, a recession.
When
there
not is a governmental organization in, by any stretch.
It's a very secretive group
they
of
just
people.
Group. This group that just meets and says, okay, we're a recession or we're not. Well,
right.
All the way up to 2007 and 2008, recessions had a definition. It was a very clear definition and one that most people could understand. It's two quarters, well, most people that follow the economy. Anyway.
Which is 50 cents.
Yeah, two quarters, 50 cents of the economy, two quarters of negative growth, let's say that correctly, shrinkage in the economy.
I love that term, negative growth.
Again, we've got to use all kinds of weird
How about 6 months of economic decline?
Okay, 6 months of or 6 months average of 3 months at a time of economic decline
equals MC squared.
Right. So basically, the math here was fairly simple. We had two quarters of economic decline right next to each other consecutively. That's what we called a recession. Then in 2007, 2008. They said, we're going to change how we do this.
Uh-huh.
We're going to look at the economy the same way we used to, but sometimes when it's growing, we're going to look at some other figures, too, to make sure that everything is growing and not just certain parts of it. So if unemployment is going up at the same time that the economy is growing weakly, and it's next to a quarter of economic decline, we're going to call that a recession.
Because we have gotten together, and I noticed the makeup of the conference board had changed a little bit at that
right.
point. And despite the fact that, according to the metrics we've been using ever since we've been calling recessions,
This isn't one,
but we feel like it's one. So
right.
we're going to come up with a new set of measurements.
Exactly.
Hey, that happens in my house on a regular basis.
There's lots of conspiracy theories amongst economists because most people that study this aren't are into conspiracy theories don't really study economics very much. But
they don't?
This happened right in the middle of an election cycle, presidential election cycle. And it may have been the reason why Barack Obama was elected. I mean, once the economy was the main concern rather than whatever else is going on, then John McCain had some problems. Okay. So having said that,
John McCain was getting blamed.
Right, because a Republican was in the White House, John McCain had to defend what was going on. Anyway, the change that's nearly irrelevant to what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here, though, is the fact that we changed the way we measured the economy had a direct impact on the economy, because this is a banking crash. We probably would have gotten the banking crash eventually, but we pushed it pretty hard. All it takes is a little shaking of confidence in banks, and banks go under. So we pushed that by saying we're having a bad economy.
So when you shake a bank, it goes under.
Right. You shake the bank a little bit, the confidence goes down, people start taking their money out, and then when they don't have the ability to take their money out, they stop making payments on their mortgages and so on.
This is a new economic theory.
Right. I think it's one of the earliest economic theories. The old statement about never start a run on a bank. Only a fool would start a run on a bank, but only a fool would not participate in one in progress. And that is a very old saying. It goes back to the origins of banks as we know them.
That's almost as old as I am.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little older than you are.
I don't know.
So the concept is if you start a run on the bank, then everybody's going to lose money. You don't do that. But once the bank has started, you better get your money out because everybody's going to lose their money.
Which takes us back to the beginning of the show. Or not show, the presentation.
Oh, yes. Go back in time.
You got to know when to hold them.
15 minutes.
You got to know when to fold them. You got to know when to walk away, and you got to know when to run on the bank.
Yes, absolutely.
So you got to the end of the whole thing.
Yes, and all of that from astronomy. Although sometimes I feel like astrology is much more interesting.
No, astronomy. That's all this really counts. Anyway, you are listening to Personal Wealth Coach, and if you would like to ask us a question or make a comment or discuss something radically different from what was discussed on the previous show, because we don't deal with bankruptcy. We don't get legal advice.
You want us to talk to radicals, though.
And, we don't talk about Well, we'll be glad to talk to you about team sports. We just won't know what the heck we're talking about or what you're talking about.
And we'll be wrong. We're confident in saying that.
Whatever we say.
We're very confident in saying that we're right now. We are correct in saying we will be wrong later. Well, we were correct before we were incorrect.
Because I could say, I don't know, and that would be correct.
That is true.
So, anyway, the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Probably ought to say that you're a, what's that, CIMA at the end of your name? What
That's
is it?
A Certified Investment Management Analyst.
Ooh,
it's a, yeah,
you're
it
an
sounds
analyst.
Great. And you are a CFP.
Right. No, no, I'm not a CFP. I'm a CFP practitioner.
You have CFP at the end of your name. Yes,
right.
That is correct.
With a little circled R at the end of it, which means I'm a Certified Financial Planner, which means that you're sort of anal and I'm certified to know the future.
We're both certifiable, though.
That's true. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
See, we confused the issue so much.
People had to call in and say, what are you guys talking about?
Yeah.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, this, let me make sure I got my, it's all the way up. I thought I might mention a little something that might stir something up here this morning.
Okay.
This is a talk program. I'm not sure that we allow talking on it, though. All right, go ahead.
Stir.
In last week's Sunday paper, they had a Parade magazine, and I think it was last week or the week before, and they were talking about the housing market.
Right.
Long thing in there. And I read all the stuff and looked at the pictures and the prices and everything.
That's what we generally do. We look at pictures.
Yeah. Coloring.
So
it's fun.
I got all through it, and I thought, gee, most of those houses look like houses I wouldn't be interested in, even if I had the money, because they look to me like many of them were, I don't know exactly how to express it, but things that would require a whole bunch of maintenance.
A real fixer-upper.
Well, not, they didn't look dilapidated or anything, but
just,
you know,
to keep it clean or to make it livable.
A good-sized house in New Jersey, and to paint it became quite a thing.
So, what do you live
brick
in now?
Frame,
kind of what kind of house do you live in now?
This is brick.
It's brick.
There's not a lot of painting in.
Well,
bricks.
No. Some people paint their bricks.
Yeah.
Well, and this one has a little bit of this. This fake board.
Ah, fake board. Yeah, you don't have to paint fake board.
I'm not sure what I can't remember what you call it. It's a brand name.
But it's.
I think they call it siding.
It's not the kind of house that requires, shouldn't be the kind that requires a lot of maintenance.
Well, congratulations. That's really good. Well, one of the things that's happened in the housing market that caused the number of houses sold, theoretically, last month to decline was they're running out of houses to sell. In other words, the number of houses listed for resale are below the number of buyers that are attempting to buy them. As a result, year over year, nationwide, this is something for some reason that has not made the headlines, resale housing prices are up 12%. Now, that's not a lot.
Compared to the drop that they took before that.
Yeah, particularly compared to the actual houses that are being sold. When you look at the drop in value that they had, a lot of those houses went down 50%, and they're now being sold for 12% more than they were than the average house last year. But one of the big issues that's going on out there is particularly the nicer houses, the ones that you probably would look at and said that looks like a nice house to have, in many cases still have mortgages on them that are significantly larger than the value of the house. So people, for some reason or another, are not trying to sell them. I don't understand why. something about, and I did this, so I'm intimately familiar with the intense pain of coming to a closing table and writing, or actually can't write it, you got to get it at the bank and carry it around, a $30,000 check, not to get into the house, but to get out of the house. And that, for some reason or another, seems to be slowing down the housing market.
I don't know why that would be. I mean, why would you have any problem with selling a house that you have to pay to sell?
And then the other side of that, of course, is when you look at what it costs to build a house today and the reluctance of banks to loan great gobs of money with very little down or anything else.
We have a shortage in
supply. Yeah, we don't have
slowly
a lot of houses being built.
Now, we still have, comparative to what is normal in a healthy economy, we still have far more houses for sale than we do than we would say in 2006 or 2005. We have more houses
really
on the market, and that's because there's still a lot of empty houses that were built.
Yep.
But they're in specific places. They're in places.
Oh yeah.
It's really hard to move them around if you live in Texas.
One of the problems.
It's really hard to live in Florida and commute to work, or live in Nevada and commute to work.
You know, so here in Texas, there are certain places where we've solved that problem. They're called mobile homes.
Right, you just move them around.
Right, you move them around.
The problem with that is that attracts tornadoes.
Right, and that's one of them. Yeah, when you cluster them together, it does attract tornadoes.
If tornadoes show up, I don't know why that is.
That just happens. Yeah,
that's
because, you know, I've read all kinds of...
There's an economic theory here somewhere. We could draw this up.
I think they build in a tornado attractor in each house.
It could be, you know.
Well, there was another thing I wanted to mention.
What's that?
In reading all the details that were in this thing, the articles, nowhere did I see anything about what I always knew as a rule of thumb in buying a house,
mm-hmm.
and that is to say it should not be more than 25% or at most stretching it 30% of your income going
mm-hmm.
to housing.
Really? So what they were saying, you should put more in?
They didn't say anything. And I thought, gee, you know, it would seem to me that they might ought to touch on that.
Well, I heard something else today.
Which may have explained why there was nothing in there.
What'd you hear?
I was watching C-SPAN, and they had a young lady there from the Washington. She's a reporter, economics reporter from Washington Post. And she was talking about, or a question came up about housing, and they specifically asked a question about the amount of income should be allocated to housing.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, it's somewhere around 43%.
Yeah, there are some conflicting concepts there. the idea behind it is you shouldn't be spending huge amounts of your income on housing. However, if someone is a normal consumer, there has been a whole set of rules of thumbs, and they've all been reexamined. Just a few years back, it was very normal for a consumer to have consumer debt, credit card, that sort of thing, a significant amount, where people were spending a fairly large percentage of their income, sometimes as much as their mortgage,
mm-hmm.
on credit cards. And if you look at it that way, you say, all right, well, using just a percentage of the income for housing, it still doesn't work out well. If they don't have large amounts of consumer debt or other debt payments going out, 43% is just fine. If they do, then you got to drop it way down to the 20% or 30%, depending on who they are.
I think part of what you may have heard there is, and I've seen that number before, if more than 43% of your total take-home income, not total income, but total take-home income, is directed to debt repayment, you're probably in trouble. And I think that may have been, the assumption may have been, that if a person has no other debt, and they're spending 43% of their take-home. And I keep emphasizing take-home here.
Yeah.
Because once you start looking at percentages of income, the 30% actually applies to gross income. That old 30% rule is you look at your gross income. That's before you pay taxes,
right,
before you make
right,
a 401k sure. contribution. And if you look at what taxes do to the gross income, and they shrink it, obviously, mm-hmm. you throw in whatever the employee is contributing to health insurance, you throw in a typical contribution to a 401k, and bingo, you're back up to that 43% very quickly. It's 30% of the gross, 43% of the net. They both amount to the same thing. Does that make sense to you?
Well, 30% was, to me, always
It's 30%, but it's 30% of the growth,
and you
gotta of the gross.
When I got my first credit cards, the only credit cards available required, $20 a year or something like that. And so that was when credit cards were really new. I'm talking
back when we had silver certificates.
Somewhere around early 1970, perhaps.
Yep. In the early 1970s, the late 1960s is when Bank AmeriCard first came out.
Uh-huh.
And it's something I'm intimately familiar with because I worked at a credit bureau at the time. And I was the person who was calling around trying to determine, we had a real windfall in that the Bank of America came to us and said, we need credit reports on the following people, and it was most of the population of the town that I lived in. And basically all the credit reporting agencies and these little tiny storefront credit reporting agencies is what we had back then, all got all they could do. And my mother actually owned the business, so she hired me one summer when I was home from school. And I spent the entire summer doing credit reports. And it was a pretty fascinating thing because it was before the Privacy Act. the things you could find. People say, no, we have privacy, the government intrusion. The things you could find out about a person from a credit bureau in a small town just by picking up the phone. Let's put it like this. I would call the bank and give someone's name, and we had a contact at the bank who would give me the balances in their accounts, the approximate balances in their accounts, but she would whisper into the telephone when she was doing it.
Because that's the way privacy should be.
That was, if I wanted
that's
to know.
That's as bad as the radio calling up and just whisper into the microphone how much so-and-so has.
Yeah, that's it. But the other thing is I would call up the local the court clerk's office. And they would tell me everything that had ever happened to that person that was on, that's because they had it in their paper records there. That's before there was any kind of privacy act. I was, if we think we don't have privacy today, we imagined we had privacy back then. But let me tell you, J. Edgar Hoover could find out everything there was to know about a person.
I think it has a lot to do with us being more aware of the privacy concerns, so we're more afraid about it. But it's kind of like people right now saying we're in the most danger we've ever been in from terrorist attacks with, the whole world could come to an end. And remind them about the Soviet Union having nuclear weapons and growing up at a time when the world really could have come to an end.
The New York Stock Exchange was bombed in the early part of the 20th century. There was a bomb put in the U.S. Senate that actually went off.
Yeah.
Terrorist
attacks. Back
in the beginning of the 20th century, it was a pretty normal thing to have bombs.
Theodore Roosevelt went and went to Tripoli over piracy and terrorism taking place in a strange place.
I thought that was Jefferson.
It was. It's Jefferson.
Jefferson, yes, did go to Tripoli.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not Theodore Roosevelt, though, I don't think. Well, he might have. Theodore Roosevelt went to Casablanca, and they hadn't even made the movie yet. Anyway, thanks for calling.
Alrighty.
All right, bye-bye. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we're going to do a break for commercials. I just wanted to mention one thing in passing that came up in that conversation that I thought was quite significant. The slowdown in availability of houses, which is causing the entire housing market to be sluggish right now. There's plenty of people who want to buy. There are plenty of people who want to sell. But the people who want to sell, in many cases, have more debt on their house than they could deal with at this point. So in order for the market price to go up, we have to have some activity in the market. The activity in the market is what enables the appraiser to come along and say, oh, yes, prices are going up, therefore your house is now worth more than it was worth before. The problem with all of that is if people are not willing to sell their houses and get movement going in the market because they owe too much, and banks are not willing to extend a large quantity of credit, like nothing down, in essence, loans on houses that are being built, then nothing happens. And the market is sluggish, and the construction people don't go back to work. I mean, it starts into this terrible mass of slowdown. Housing traditionally is a big part of the American economy. It's not a big part of the American economy right now. And the reason, when you look at all these things I just mentioned, you can understand why our economic growth on an annualized basis in the first quarter was only 2.5%. There's just a lot of things we haven't worked through yet that accumulated in the last boom.
Yeah, I'm going to add to that in just a second. Yes, Theodore Roosevelt sent a fleet to Morocco.
Somewhere.
Based on Jefferson.
Someplace in Africa.
But he used Jefferson's precedent in Tripoli.
Jefferson was the precedent.
But back to...
He sent a fleet to Morocco?
Yes, because there was banditry and piracy, and an American was kidnapped, and so he sent a fleet to... But it was the same concepts, and they used the precedent. So I had linked something weird in my brain.
They were both presidents.
Right. And back to the 2.5% growth in the first quarter.
Yeah, we don't talk about that some more after the commercial.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about a whole series of things about it. Let's do commercials first.
And I wanted to talk about a whole series of things about that, too. You
know? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but what else
is about it?
What else is about it? We'll be back on the other side of these critically important messages from Town Square Media's sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a caller, which is always a little astonishing to us, on 1-866-597-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay. Just curious, you were just talking about homes, and the last time I went to Salado, my son was visiting, and he was curious as to that big old house right next to the Methodist Church. It used to be a restaurant or a private home.
Oh, I think it just sold.
Yeah, the Methodist Church is there. Yes,
it isn't there anymore. Yeah, it's the La Mansion, it was called. Right.
Yeah. He called the realtor, and I think the price was like over $800,000.
Yeah, you know, it was originally much higher than that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, because, it's not a house. It's a restaurant.
Looking at it, I know that there's going to be a lot of repairs and maintenance and
Well, it was actually a restaurant, and so it's not a house. And the problem that they ran into is the Salado does not have a sewer system, and the size of the aerobic system that they would have to put in versus the number of people they could seat in there comfortably and safely and feed apparently didn't work out to the previous owners. Now, somebody's bought it, so I guess they figure they're going to turn it around and do it again.
Yeah, Salado has been looking to put in a sewer system for a while, but what they have found is that the grants that they could get from the federal government or from the state don't apply to them because they're too rich, which is a statement about their effluent being too affluent.
Right.
Yes.
That makes sense. Anyway, does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Was it a private person that bought it or
got me? Don't know. They don't release that information.
We could call up the bank and have them whisper it to us, but I don't think they're allowed to do it anymore.
But we'd have to figure out which bank it was we had to call, you know.
Well, he was just curious, and I said, because their taxes that they pay, that they live 200 miles from here, are like $4,000 a year now. And I said, oh, my gosh.
What's the value of their house?
$0.06 to $0.12.
What's the appraised value of their house, roughly?
Pardon?
How much is their house worth upon which they're paying the $4,000 in taxes?
They bought it about 8 years ago, and it's almost doubled in price.
Yeah, but that doesn't tell me what it's worth.
Oh,
what's it appraised at?
It's probably worth about $175 now.
Wow. Taxes are much higher there.
Yes. He works for the railroad, and he's doing quite well.
Well, yeah, but the house, let me tell you, the taxes there are sure a heck of a lot higher than they are here. Okay.
Oh yeah, and they've gone up. The taxes have
so
gone
where does he live?
40% in the last 8 years that they bought.
What state? Where does he live?
He lives down in a little place called Dayton, which is south of Liberty, Texas.
Oh, okay.
It's halfway
okay.
between Houston and Beaumont.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye. I was thinking a little place called Dayton, as in Ohio.
No, that's not.
No.
It's a little
wow.
place.
Someplace, well, it makes me feel a lot better.
They might have nice schools there.
Yeah, I just looked at our property taxes. I could tell you that my house is worth more than $175,000, and my taxes are about half of what he's paying. Apparently.
Well, just think, if it hasn't happened already, you will be very shortly have that grandfather clause because you're a grandfather, where your taxes will be.
Well, actually, I do get a discount in year after next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's cool.
So what you're saying is you're old.
Yes.
Or maybe
yes.
I was the one saying that.
No,
I thought I'd point that out.
I am old, yes. Very definitely. Anyway, we were going to discuss...
GDP growth.
The GDP.
GDP.
Which is really gross,
but not as gross as it could be.
Well, it's gross and it's domestic.
Yes. Yeah, so what's funny about the gross domestic product is it's actually a net number.
Well, it's the net gross net.
Yes, and that is very confusing as are most jargon terms from economics. But
what are you talking about?
That we have a 2.5% growth, which I suspect will be moved upward in their revisions that's coming soon. It's a statement about a lot of things. Well, the reason why I suspect that is because while revenue has been a little bit has been up or flat, net has been much higher. So earnings after
Let's come back to this from a different direction.
We had a payroll tax.
We did.
That came in at the beginning of the year, as well as several
right.
other taxes that are related to health care.
Right.
Which
people are not paying yet.
No, but they will, and that's apparent. But the part about the payroll tax, people are paying that immediately. That is coming out of their pay.
And if you're making a whole bunch of money, your taxes on your earnings went up 0.9%.
Right. And while you say people aren't paying that yet.
No, I mean the 3.8% tax on investment income is not, it's not
that's,
withholding.
See, that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay, what are you talking about?
I am self-employed. You are self-employed. We are.
And I thought I was unemployed.
We mandate to ourselves that we're not employed by other people, therefore
right.
we are unemployed.
Right.
What it comes down to is that last year I was able to deduct anything over 7.5% on medical
yes.
of my adjusted
mm-hmm.
gross
right.
income.
Right.
And this year I have to get to 10% before I can do that.
Right.
So I have changed the amount that I send into the IRS every
quarter.
But you're
weird. You know you're weird.
Yeah. So anyway, IRS is getting more money. So I'm spending less money in the economy because...
But you're exceptional.
I recognize that you think I'm weird and exceptional.
Because you actually calculated this out and adjusted the amount of money that was being withheld from your pay. People normally wait until after.
And then they have to cough it up when it's a lot more painful.
More fun to put it off.
Any way you look at it, though, there is a higher tax. And the payroll tax is the big one that's affecting the economy because it's a lot of the...
lower income people
yeah. that have been kind of driving, for instance, Walmart. And
I disagree with you on this.
Walmart's had some earnings drop directly attributable to this.
Well, This is the point. We'll pick up the caller left. We obviously bored him to tears. We had a caller.
Or bored them to hang up, at least.
Can I bring a different perspective on that?
Sure.
Okay. Consumer spending in the first quarter was up 3.2%. Now, the whole GDP is up only up 2.5.
Right.
So consumer spending rose 3.2%, which is more than wages rose.
Yep.
Which indicates that anything that was taken out of the wages didn't seem to have slowed people down very
but,
much.
See, I've got another perspective to even that. And people are listening going, man, these guys are nerds. Yes, we are. That's why you're listening.
Now, we've gone past nerd. I think we're geeks.
We're way into the geekdom.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true.
We went to the opera the other night together.
Yes.
And I must admit that while I was sitting there, I was thinking, where's the pause button?
Exactly.
Yes. If I had a choice between sitting at my computer,
I would much rather have done the computer. Yes, but it was it was very beautiful.
It was a beautiful
opera.
We have
to say the opera
was
beautiful.
But it was wonderful. If you like operas,
okay. So, what you said is absolutely true. 3.2% increase in consumer spending.
Right.
I think what we'll find as the numbers come out more is which part of consumer spending increased, because the lower income did not, and that's been driving the market. But we're having more automobile sales, we're having larger equipment sales,
sailing automobiles.
We're having things like washers and dryers being sold.
That's because money laundering is up.
Yes, you got to keep your money clean when the washer and dryer is
however
the best way to. But going to, like, for instance, Walmart, we had the lower income has been helping the economy go. That was the whole concept behind the Obama stimulus plan,
right,
which is why the payroll tax wasn't
the
there to begin with.
The poor people continued to spend all their money every month.
Yes, right. And because they have less money in their all to spend every month, they were still spending all of their money, but it was less money. And so the things that have been driving the economy have slowed down, and the things that are gearing up to drive the economy are still not up to full speed, which is why we had sluggish growth.
Walmart claimed it was the slowdown in spending in their stores was because of the payroll tax increase, but Wall Street Journal had a really good, I think it was Wall Street Journal, someplace, may have been The Economist. I read The Economist. I read
What
Financial
would The
Times.
Economist be doing at Walmart?
Well, they were several places last week talked about, not this most recent week, talked about what happened at Walmart. What happened at Walmart apparently was they cut staffing to the point where they couldn't keep stuff on the shelves, and that's the real reason they had decline in sales, not people not having enough money. I don't know. You may be completely correct. There is something about the GDP.
Combinations there. But we had growth, and that's the thing that I wanted to bring this up. 2.5% growth
is still growth.
When we compare it to Europe, which is the thing that the place in the world that is closest to what we are is Europe, and Europe is
European,
just falling off.
Yeah, it's not doing well at all.
It's not doing the Spanish unemployment rate is up at 28% now, and that's not 28% of the young population. It's like 50% of the young population. It's 28% of everybody that's unemployed.
And Germany, arguably the healthiest economy in the Eurozone or in Europe, folks, I hate to say this, but they're carrying 50% more debt when compared with their GDP as we are, and their GDP is about half of what ours is. I want to point out something here about the numbers that came out on the GDP that's very, very, very important, in my opinion. The private economy last quarter, the non-government economy, grew at an annualized rate of 3.3%. Now, that's going to be revised down the road. It probably will be revised upward. That's the way these things normally work out. The government shrunk, was a negative, what they call negative growth. The government spending in the economy declined last quarter, and the biggest decline, hang on to your seats, folks, was in the federal government.
Whoa, wait a minute.
And this was even before much of it was before sequestration even hit.
Yeah.
So what we have is the private economy growing at 3.3% with a lot of headwinds and things going on. the government economy, particularly the federal economy, that oddly enough, states and local municipalities have leveled off, but the federal spending cuts were really what took down the GDP below expectations. And this is the amazing thing to me. The economists who were expecting a 3.2% growth out of the total economy, they were really, really close in the part of the economy they were looking at. They didn't take into account the effect of government spending, how much government spending, federal government spending, was cut in the first quarter. So any of you diehard conservative Republicans who really wanted to see the federal government spend less money, well, they are. They're spending a lot less money. And that probably, unless there's some massive change somewhere, which I doubt, will accelerate going forward. The cuts will actually get larger as we move forward into next year.
And part of this is good and part of this is bad, which is great. We can cover both sides and people go, well, why didn't you talk about the good part? Well, we did. And what about the bad part? Well,
because
we did that too.
It's because you have two hands and four arms.
Right. And if I have four arms and two hands, where I'm missing two, aren't I?
I don't know. But you're an economist, and you can always say, on the other hand.
Have enough hands to go around.
Well, no, you only have one other hand, or you'd say on one of the other hands.
The type of spending decrease that we've been seeing in Europe, took place, you know, these economies that are collapsing.
Europe took place?
Yeah, these things in Europe took place.
Oh, okay. I started to say Europe.
Greece and
Europe happened a really long time.
Italy and Spain, they have these great cuts that they're taking to their government pay. The government is spending a lot less.
I like the way Spain does it, though.
Yeah, they're just cutting all over the place.
No, they keep people employed.
Right.
They haven't really laid anybody off. They just don't pay them.
Exactly. This week, for the first time, some of the Greek civil servants have been laid off. And this is really a big deal because that doesn't happen in Greece. They haven't been paid, but now they're being laid off and saying, you can't work here because we don't have money and we never will.
I think they should do it like the Salado city government does. They should pay their civil servants exactly the way we pay our village alderman and mayor.
With just $25 a year, something like that?
We don't.
You don't? Oh, that makes sense. I mean, and look at the great service that they provide.
Yeah, and then we do pay our legislators in Texas, I think, what, $500 a year?
Yeah.
Whether they need it or not?
Yeah, so coming back to these cuts in government spending, this is an axiom, a truism, a statement of fact. In a recession, if you raise taxes, you're doing a bad thing to the economy. This is a truism, an axiom, a fact. In a recession, if you cut government spending, you're doing harm to the economy.
Whoa, both of these, you're going to be accused of being a Keynesian here.
Right. Both of these are not theories. This isn't some kind of economic theory of maybe this will happen or maybe it won't. This isn't Keynesianism. It isn't any of the... It isn't even Freud, if you... You say one thing and mean your mother.
I'm afraid that you're... I'm
saying if you remove money that was being spent from an economy when it is in contraction, you will increase the contraction. It's not a difficult...
It's kind of like having a baby.
Yes. Exactly. However, if you're in growth and you cut spending in the government, sometimes that increases the growth on the private side. So this is why the conservatives are all happy about cutting growth. But sometimes if your economy isn't moving forward fast enough yet, you can cause a recession. If you raise taxes in a good economy, it very rarely causes a recession. However, if you raise taxes in a bad economy, it very rarely does anything good. So they're saying both sides of this is very important because the political spectrum, they say all or nothing. Raising taxes is always bad, or lowering taxes is always bad, depending on which side you stand on. Cutting spending is always good, or cutting spending is always bad, depending on which side you're standing on. And the reality is that it depends on when, where, why, and a lot of other things.
Well, we're going to see this year.
We are going to see. It's going to be an experiment. Do we have enough growth right now in our economy to cut spending at the governmental level and raise taxes at the governmental level and still have growth?
Yeah,
it's a good experiment. We'll see what happens.
If your adjusted gross income is over $250,000 this year, you will see some interesting things happen to your taxes.
Yep.
And, for instance, on investment income. Now, there's a lot of things excluded from that, so don't try this yourself at home, even with TurboTax. But you will see a 3.8% flat tax on investment income if your adjusted gross income is over $250,000 this year. So there's a lot of people have been discussing, a lot of articles have been discussing how to avoid that. I don't think a lot of people are going to successfully avoid it unless you got about $1 bazillion.
How much is that? How many zeros is a bazillion?
It is an uncountable number. It's your eyeballs cross as an attempt to count.
Ah, that's the definition of bazillion,
yeah.
Is the crossed eyes.
And I love what the Wall Street Journal recommended, that you should invest in something that is run out of the Cayman Islands and or someplace like that. You fully disclose it. It's just that you do that, but you avoid the 3.8% tax as long as you leave the money there and don't bring it home. So the issue is, as long as you leave the money someplace else and don't spend it and don't ever receive it, you can avoid taxes on investment income, which I thought is one of the more stupid things I have ever read in my life, but that's all right. If you have that much money that you don't need it, why are you worried about a 3.8% tax?
Exactly.
On money you don't need.
Well, don't need and don't. Yeah, so you're talking about the strangeness of getting rid of the tax carefully
why would you do that? If you
take
100% of your money and you put it in some place that the FDIC doesn't insure it, in a tiny little island someplace where if they get a little overthrow, you lose it all.
Yeah.
To so save 3.8% on taxes.
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
But there's an awful lot of things that people do. We're out of time.
Yes, we're almost out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air.
Why would anyone want to contact us off the air?
Because we manage portfolios. We are in wealth management, and we do it on a fiduciary basis. That was like an infomercial. You ask a question, you know the answer.
We are professional investment managers.
Yes.
We're trying to figure out what we are, by the way. We're still going through this identity crisis from our childhood.
And
anyway,
if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at 947-1111. You were drinking.
I was?
Yes. And toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com or go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com.
We'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
In Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.